Good afternoon. We'll call to order the House Committee on Judiciary, Civil Law, and welcome everybody, the committee members. I thought we had more in here when we started. Oh, we're losing them by the minute.
Do you need me?
No, I guess not. We'll start with the public hearing. We've got a big enough group to do that. Move into a public hearing on Senate Bill 50. I trust our members who are in the hall will be right back. So I'll open that public hearing. Council.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Senate Bill 50A amends ORS 20.080, which is the law requiring the court to award attorney's fees to prevailing plaintiff in actions for damages for personal injury or property damage where the amount pled is $5,000 or less, and establishes a similar increase for award of attorney's fees to a defendant on may prevail on a counterclaim. Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Thank you. I've got Greg Mao and Stacey Hinken. Is she out there, too?
You have Greg Mao. I'll run out.
Okay, that's fine. Cool. We'll take it easy. My witnesses are in the hall. My committee is in the hall. Welcome back, both of you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Greg Mao, and sitting beside me is Stacey Hinken. We are both attorneys practicing in Portland. I'm a partner with the firm of Stoll Reeves. I'm secretary of the Oregon State Bar's Procedure and Practice Committee, and Ms. Hinken is chair of that committee. The Procedure and Practice Committee is composed of attorneys throughout the state. It's evenly balanced between attorneys who primarily represent defendants and those who primarily represent plaintiffs in civil litigation. Members of the committee use their experience and knowledge to enhance the effectiveness of the civil justice system, and not on behalf of particular clients or particular causes. It was in this context that we originally proposed Senate Bill 50. ORS 20.080 currently provides for an award of attorney's fees in actions for personal injury or property damage where the amount pled is $4,000 or less. In order to collect any attorney fees at all, the plaintiff must prevail in the action and must be awarded more than what the defendant offered prior to the filing of the lawsuit. The statute also provides for an award of attorney's fees to a defendant where the defendant prevails on a counterclaim of $4,000 or less. The current version of ORS 20.080 was enacted in 1955, first enacted. At that time, the limit was $1,000. And the law was intended to balance the rights and duties of parties in small claims. On the one hand, the statute's intended to prevent defendants from refusing to settle and pay just but small claims, inasmuch as it would be difficult for a plaintiff to find an attorney to pursue such a claim. On the other hand, the pleading amount was kept low as a warning to plaintiffs not to inflate small claims beyond just amounts in order that the defendant could in good faith settle those claims without resorting to the court system. The original version of Senate Bill 50, which we sponsored, would have increased the pleading limit to $7,500 for both claims and counterclaims. On the Senate side, the bill was amended at the request of other interested parties to increase the pleading limit by $1,000 to a total of $5,000, and that's the bill that is currently before your committee. The Procedure and Practice Committee believes that $7,500 is still the most appropriate increase because it represents a compromise between competing interests. We therefore offer an amendment to Senate Bill 50 to increase the pleading amounts for both plaintiffs and defendants from $5,000 to $7,500. The basis for our proposed amendment is threefold. First, according to national statistics for the insurance industry, for those claims under $50,000, the average property claim has increased almost 58% since 1985, the last time the pleading limit was raised, or from $1,100 to $1,900, while the average personal injury claim has increased 56% from $4,000 to $7,043. Second, prior to proposing the legislation, we surveyed judges throughout the state. All of the judges who provided us with input on this issue recommended an increase in the pleading limit. Many of them, the majority of them actually, identified $10,000 as the appropriate amount. Finally, we consulted with an economist who advised us that since 1985, the average rate of inflation was 3%. We've also been told, however, that using 3% as a baseline does not take into account the fact that medical expenses increase at a greater rate than normal inflation. Based on all this information, we thought that increasing the pleading limit to $7,500 would appropriately balance competing interests. And if I could digress just for a moment here, we recognize that whatever number we proposed would become potentially a subject of negotiation and compromise. And we struggled with this issue because we felt the $7,500 was the correct number to end up on. But we also recognized that we were a committee of the Oregon State Bar and perhaps in a somewhat different position than another party might be proposing legislation. So we proposed what we proposed to you was what actually represented a compromise within our group, which, again, was balanced between plaintiffs and defendants' attorneys. We anticipate that increasing the pleading limit to $7,500 would actually reduce litigation costs. At least one carrier has indicated that by raising the pleading limit to $7,500, more than 50% of their claims would be subject to ORS 20.080. At the present time, very few ORS 20.080 cases go to trial. By increasing the percentage of cases potentially subject to ORS 20.080, litigation costs would go down as more cases would resolve before trial and potentially even before entering the court system. The pleading limit in ORS 20.080 has not been increased since 1985. Over the past 13, now 14 years, actual claim costs, inflation, and other economic realities have tipped the balance away from individuals with small but meritorious claims. Increasing the pleading limit to $7,500 will restore that balance. The Procedure and Practice Committee believes that with this increase, defendants and plaintiffs in these cases would be more motivated to fairly evaluate and amicably resolve claims without litigation. I would be happy to respond to any questions, and so would the chair of our committee, Stacey Hankin.
Stacey, do you have any testimony of your own?
No, okay. Chair Shadley.
All right, questions? No questions. All right, let's go to the next one. Thank you. If you want to stick around. John Powell and Tim Mortland, is it? And why don't you come on up together, the two of you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Powell. I represent North Pacific Insurance Companies, and with me today is counsel from that company, Mr. Mortland, and I would like him to explain our position on Senate Bill 50.
Thank you. Excuse me, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Tom Mortland. I'm currently employed as a claims manager for North Pacific Insurance Company. Prior to my employment as a claims manager responsible for claims throughout the state of Oregon, I was employed as an attorney. I practiced law in the state of Oregon from 1976 through 1995. So I'm familiar both with the issue that we're talking about today from a practice standpoint and also from a claim standpoint, from the insurance company perspective. Very simply put, this statute, ORS 20.080, was proposed, adopted originally to apply to small claims. The effect of increasing the limit of that statute from $4,000 to $7,500, although on its face does not appear to be a large increase, is actually a very significant increase. As the prior speaker indicated, the average property damage claim that an insurance company paid, I think he cited industry statistics, at about $1,900, and the average personal injury claim payment of about $7,400 are both below the limit that is proposed to apply to small claims. So what's proposed as a statute for small claims is actually, if this were to be adopted with a $7,500 limit, would apply to the average of both personal injury and property damage claims. That's a significant difference. The principal reason that we object to that increase is the effect that it would in reality have upon litigation, upon the incentive and the interest that attorneys and litigants have in filing suit. From an attorney's perspective, I would like that increase. If I'm a practicing attorney, it allows me to change the dynamics of the demand, negotiation, and litigation process in my client's favor. It allows me to claim attorney fees in addition to the amount of the claim itself. Attorneys will support this, both plaintiff and defense attorneys, because it does tend to promote the filing of lawsuits, the claim for attorney fees, and the additional expense that brings both to the payment of claims and to the process itself. From a claim standpoint, from an insurance company perspective, the inevitable result of a statute like this, of an increase like this, would be to increase the cost of claims, to increase the average of the claim itself, to include the extra that has to inevitably be paid for attorney fees. So the net effect is to increase the interest of people in filing lawsuits, to increase the cost of resolving those lawsuits, to increase the time it takes to resolve those lawsuits, and to increase ultimately the cost of those average claims, not just small claims, but the average claim that we and other carriers pay. I urge you not to increase the amount to the $7,500 to $7,500 proposed. We would support or agree to an increase to the $5,000 level as it passed in the Senate, and urge you to support that as well. I would be pleased to answer any questions the committee has.
Here's one, Representative Williams.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Mortland is a practicing attorney, as you were before you went in-house with North Pacific. I mean, I'm sure you've been in a situation where you have pleaded a lower damage amount than your clients had actually suffered in a case in order to get under the $4,000 cap, because you knew that the attorney's fees provision would actually bring the parties together to discuss settlement sooner rather than later, I suspect. Am I right about that?
Representative Williams, that's correct, that as a practitioner, it's a calculated risk to plead an amount that fits within the statute to be able to have the additional leverage that the statute provides, because the insurance company for a party insured is therefore faced with an additional risk, and it tends to drive up the cost of that claim. So very definitely, as a practitioner, I would attempt to, in an appropriate case, fit within the limit of ORS 20080. If it went to 7,500, again, as a practitioner, as an attorney, I would try to fit as many claims as possible under that statute, because I know I get more, my client gets more, the cost goes up. The point or the effect of increasing this to 7,500 is that more claims fit within that amount, and including the average claim.
Mr. Chairman, but doesn't it also mean that I mean, in cases where I've actually done this, and they haven't always been insurance-related claims. I mean, this is a provision of the law that applies to any kind of a property damage situation that doesn't necessarily have to be directly related to insurance. But doesn't it also mean that people are at least giving up what they believe, at least to some degree, is the value of their claim in order to fit within the framework of the statute? I mean, I've had clients who've had damages in excess of the $4,000, but as we've done the calculus, have agreed that we would plead it under the $4,000 amount, And so in some degree, they're walking away from some damages that they're frankly entitled to, which is, you know, kind of a trade-off. I mean, they're giving that up to get within the framework of the statute, which are damages that wouldn't be recoverable now once you pleaded it within that framework for purposes of having those settlement discussions.
Representative Williams, it is, I believe, accurate. Your experience, like mine, is that within a fairly narrow range where damages particularly tend to be subjective. A personal injury case is a good example where if I had a client who had sustained personal injuries and the evaluation, the evaluation that I placed on that case might be in a range that was close to the statutory limit, by all means, I would opt and encourage my client to opt to fit within the statute. In another case where my client had clearly sustained property damage, for example, that was definitively beyond the limit, I had an obligation as an attorney not to compromise damages purely to take advantage of this statute unless my client was fully aware of the consequence and agreed to do that, and they might in an appropriate case. Again, the effect here would be that in many personal injury type cases that are presented, that choice would likely be made, and rather than give up something they might be entitled to, the effect, in my view, would be, and I think our experience indicates the effect would be, that people would consciously make choices in any case or most cases where the damages weren't clear to fit within the statute and to litigate or to use that extra leverage. In regard to your comment about insurance, it's true the statute does not, by its terms, apply only to an insurance claim. The reality is that, in my experience, I think if you look at the cases decided under this statute by our appellate courts, almost invariably they deal with insurance. And in fact, the court has said that that's why this statute exists, to require defendants, but in reality, usually insurance companies, to pay small claims without causing people to litigate. It has its intended effect. It works very well as it currently exists, which is why we oppose any significant or substantial change.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd just be interested, Mr. Mortland, because of your relationship and seeing the kind of the inside perspective from an entity who pays these claims, what your thoughts were about Mr. Mao's testimony about the economist's analysis of the 3% since 1985, the average inflation rate of 3%. Do you think it makes sense for the legislature to not have to revisit this on a regular basis to put some sort of an indexing mechanism in a statute like this?
Representative Williams, I don't have any economic statistics or analysis at hand, so I certainly don't have any reason to question the information that Mr. Mao presented. Whether it's appropriate to index, if you will, the statute to some external indicator such as the a price index or an inflation index, something like that, I hesitate to address. I think you'd have a host of parameters or indexes or information that you could address, including the cost of claims. I guess before I answer that, I'd like to know the sort of the relative increases of claim costs, average claim payments. I don't know what that history is, and I'd be reluctant to address that further without that.
Good. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Warbelow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, before I ask my question, I'd just like to mention an aside. You said that all the appellate cases, or majority of appellate cases, show that this is mainly used in insurance context, personal injury cases. But those are only the cases that go on appeal. You don't know what the context that the other cases have arisen would have been settled. Is that not correct?
Representative Uberlau, and I apologize if I mispronounce your name. I'm speaking from a perspective with which I'm familiar, so that's very true that the cases that reach the appellate level may not be representative. What, in addition, my experience reflects is a practice related to insurance claims on both sides of the fence, if you will, having represented parties making claims and having represented insurance companies or their insured. So that's my experience, and I think I would assert that that's an experience with which most attorneys are familiar, but I would not assert that it has exclusive or even that's the only application that it would have.
Chair?
Yes.
Actually, as an attorney, I have experienced these all over the place, and I can't say that they're all PEI cases by any means. But I find it rather curious, and I'd like you to explain a little more, why you think this would cost insurance companies more. I think it would cost it less, and let me tell you why, and you can respond. This, the statute as it is now actually encourages settlement. We heard testimony to that. From my personal experience, I find that to be true, and I think most attorneys will tell you that. When we settle, costs are kept at a minimum. You don't have to go to trial. You don't have attorney's fees on both sides, the cost of the court cost, and so forth. So they save money now. Why would they not save money if we raised the amount to $750? It just means more claims will now be subject to settlement, which is what we want to encourage.
Representative Uberlau, I certainly concur with your view that we should encourage settlement, and that attempting to encourage settlement as opposed to litigation is a positive thing. I don't question that in any way by opposing this increase. Rather, my experience and my view is that when the statute is available to apply to a claim that I have, if I'm representing the person making the claim, my incentive is to make that claim. The incentive of the insurance company faced with that claim is to quite probably pay more to resolve that claim than would be required to pay it if that statute didn't exist. In other words, these cases tend to carry a premium for attorney fees in addition to the claim itself. As an attorney, I would also have an incentive to actually file that case with the court in order to exert maximum leverage upon the defendant and its insurance company to assert the claim to attorney fees. There's a certain procedure to be followed, as you well know, and in my experience, I found that the way to exert maximum leverage was to file suit and to assert that claim and to proceed to attempt to collect attorney fees where possible. And again, where the statute applied in claims under $4,000, that was readily available. Without that statute, I found myself negotiating without attempting to collect attorney fees. And that's simply a real-world experience that I have encountered on numerous occasions on both sides of the picture, if you will, plaintiffs and defendants.
I'm still puzzled. For example, you have to make your demand, the claimant, I think it's 10 days before you actually file a case. So you're going forward before you file the case. And when you go forward, I don't know how you practice, but most attorneys would send their proof, perhaps doctor's bills, whatever the health care bills were and so forth, and say, I think a reasonable settlement figure is this. And then if you don't respond, you can file suit. Also, I think another break on the process, so to speak, is you're not going to get attorney's fees if you file unless you get more than you demanded at trial. And so that also is, you better make sure you have all your ducks in a row, the claimant, that you can go in and prove more. You think you're making a reasonable offer. So again, I really don't, you're not making it clear to me what your reasoning is that you actually think that this would cost. All I see it as doing is adding to the number of people who would be able to use this vehicle. And maybe that won't even be true, because although you talk about a 3% inflation rate, between 1985 and now, actually, healthcare costs, inflation was as much as 14% at one time, and that's what most of your costs are going to be in these claims, especially if we're talking about PI claims. So I don't know that if they're going to be much different than what we had in the past, given the change in healthcare costs. So maybe you can say something else that will get me to the point where you are right now, that if we raise the figure, we're going to raise the price to the insurance companies.
Representative Uberlau, again, I'm not sure that I can clarify this to the point where, I think this is in some very real respects a reflection of the experience that I had as a practitioner And that experience very clearly was dealing primarily with insurance claims, primarily with property damage claims. As a practitioner, when the amount in the statute was $4,000, or before 1985 when it was $3,000, I rarely, if ever, made a personal injury claim within the limits of the statute. Most personal injury claims were outside that limit. When the amount goes to $7,500, more and more claims for personal injury will be made, which by their nature tend to be less objective in terms of evaluation. So I think what this does is open the door to more people making claims for personal injury that don't have clear amounts in terms of their value as opposed to the amount of damage to a vehicle, and that's the result that I would expect and predict will occur, is that a lot of these claims will be made, and insurance companies will respond to them by attempting very hard to settle those, including paying a premium to avoid the risk, the other side of what you experienced, which is if we go to trial and lose, we could quite possibly owe substantially more than the claim itself is worth. So maybe it's two sides to the same coin, and I'm not sure if that answers your question, but that's how I see it.
Mr. Chairman, if I might
yes.
conclude,
no.
Perhaps the best answer is the one given by the Attorney General's office in 1985 when this was last increased from $3,000 to $4,000, and I'll submit this for the record. It's a testimony that was submitted by William Cloran, Assistant Attorney General in 1985, in which he stated in that testimony, by offering plaintiff's lawyers, and I'm quoting, an inducement to prosecute small cases involving disputed sums, the bill promotes litigation in an already overburdened system. Rather than amending ORS 20.080 to increase the limits for attorney fee awards, we recommend that ORS 20.080 be repealed entirely. And again, I think we're talking about a system that hopefully is to define small cases. And I'd remind the committee that I think this session, the small claims court jurisdiction is going to $5,000. And that's one of the reasons we agreed to the $5,000 limit on the other side. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you for the opportunity to
thank
appear.
You for coming forward. Let's have Lana Butterfield and Tom Krenovich and John Clements. Let's see, you're against.
Yes. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Lana Butterfield. I'm here representing Safeco Insurance Company. With me is John Clements. John is one of Safeco's claims casualty unit managers. And you've met Tom Krenovich. He appeared before you a couple weeks ago. Tom is our managing attorney for Safeco. Yes, we object to any increase, whether it be $6,000 or $7,500. We object to any more increase. We had some amendments over in the Senate, but we did not pursue those here because we thought the Senate found a good balance. We can live with $5,000. We can't live with anything more. And so we would object to anything over that amount. I'm going to let John and Tom talk to the issue.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Clements. I'm a claims unit manager at Safeco. I've been at Safeco in the claims department for the last 19 years. I think I'd like to first address the inflationary issue that's been mentioned by simply saying that what an increase of $7,500 would be doing is dealing with inflation by adding another inflationary layer to the proposal. Mr. Mortland, I think, addressed many of the issues that I wanted to mention, so I'm going to try not to be too repetitive. Senate Bill 50, I think, has many adverse impacts. One is definitely higher premiums that can be expected from that. I think we can expect some increased litigation. And the reason why we would anticipate increased litigation is because the only thing that triggers the recovery of attorney fees is the filing of a lawsuit. Without the lawsuit, the attorney fees are not a factor. We can expect increased cost of settlements as defendants seek to avoid litigation. And Mr. Morton appropriately mentioned that we could... I lost my train of thought.
I'm sorry.
We can increase cost of settlements as defendants seek to avoid litigation, and that's because a premium would be paid or is attempted as claims people to want to avoid lawsuits, and so we feel that we are paying more than the claim is actually worth. We can also anticipate more appeals of arbitrations on the parts of insurers. As you are dealing with a larger and larger amount, there becomes less willingness to simply accept the result in arbitration. And so there's a temptation to appeal and continue to overburden the system. Under Senate Bill 50, smaller claims would cost more to handle than many larger claims. A claim that should be worth $4,000 may now cost us $4,000 plus attorney fees that are substantially more than that. And so it has the opposite effect, it's adverse to the premise that settling smaller claims should cost less than larger claims. I think it increases the time from the date of loss to the settlement as plaintiffs seek to maximize recovery and fees. And when you're dealing with bodily injuries, you're dealing with many subjective type factors, and so it's not like a property damage claim that would settle rather quickly. With a bodily injury claim, you're definitely going to increase the overall life cycle of the claim. And I think it also increases the potential of inflated fraudulent claims. I think we cannot assume that all claims have merit. Most do, but there are a lot of claims out there in a very low-speed vehicle type accidents and other types of claims where the prospects of not only recovering a claim but attorney fees as well will increase the desire of people who may not otherwise file a claim to do so. In terms of dollar amounts that are involved, at Safeco, our current average bodily injury claim is $6,018. That is only an increase of $708 on the average from 1985. And in physical damage, the change is from $865 in 1985, and now it's $1,853. And so the increase there is, I'm sorry, I gave you some.
1853 now.
Okay. It's 1853 in physical damage today, and in 1985, it was $988, so an increase of $865. So I think in conclusion, we believe that ORS 20.080, as it's currently formulated at $4,000 or even $5,000, adequately protects those with small claims. And I think I would just like to say that we need to look at these claims not only from the standpoint of the plaintiff, but also from the standpoint of the insurance buying public, those that would be also be defendants in lawsuits, because it's not ultimately the insurance company that bears that burden, but the consumer that would, we believe, pay a higher premium. Thank you.
Questions? Representative Werbelow.
Thank you. Actually, your testimony is a little disturbing. in the fact that this person who's making the claim is also your consumer and also your policyholder, and yet you're making statements like they're all out there to do fraud on you, or they have these claims that aren't valid, they're subjective. So is there only value when they pay their premium?
Representative Uberla, no. Most claims are settled amicably. We're talking about a smaller percentage that do go through the litigation process. We are dealing usually with the defendants being our insurers. And so our primary obligation is to our insurers. But we do recognize our obligations to those that have been that are impacted by what our insurers do. And so we take that very seriously. We do not believe that it requires a Senate bill such as this for insurance companies to do the right thing. I think there is a natural tendency on our part and on the part of everybody who works for Safeco and other insurance companies to do the right thing, to evaluate claims correctly, and to not treat those making claims to be fraud. We assume that we start with the assumption that people are honest, and the majority are. So when I'm talking about fraudulent claims, I'm only talking about a very small percentage of the public.
Sure.
Actually, you said something very important, and you were saying that you pride yourself on evaluating claims correctly, and you are claims examiners. If that is true, and you actually value them correctly, then you really have no concern about attorney's fees if they go to trial. They only get attorney's fees if they go to trial and they are awarded more than what their demand has been. Now, if you decide not to settle with them because you don't agree with their demand, that means, and then they get more at trial, that means you're not evaluating the claim correctly. Or it means you have evaluated, but you just don't want to pay that amount out.
Representative Rubala, I hope that's the correct pronunciation. I believe I'm going to let Mr. Krenovich answer that question, because he is an attorney and a litigator. But just briefly, when we're evaluating bodily injury claims, we're dealing with a very subjective component, namely general damages. And so there's no formula out there, as there might be in a property damage claim, where you can say, okay, these cars are selling for $2,000 on the open market. Here we're dealing with the pain and suffering of individuals, and we're dealing with medical bills that will not usually be part of 20.080, because those medical bills will have been covered by PIP. So we're dealing with the pain and suffering component, the very subjective a part of the claim, and it's not going to be the same for two individuals, because no one suffers equally or in the same fashion. So when you're dealing with so much subjectiveness, to be always correct in the evaluation is not, I don't believe, feasible. You try to be fair, you try to rely on your experience, but sometimes there will be differences of opinion. And this bill creates the incentive for that difference of opinion, because the plaintiff, I believe, now has this additional hammer over insurance companies.
Before they go on, I want to clarify one thing.
Yeah.
Actually, you can be dealing with much more than pain and suffering. You can be dealing with wage loss. You can be dealing with what it costs to get to the doctors. You may have an objective injury, like a broken arm, a broken leg. And even though PIP pays, PIP is their own insurance carrier who's paying that, and they will seek reimbursement. So
they will seek reimbursement outside of this particular statute, because they have a direct right of action for PIP, which also includes some wage loss. There are some components that would not be paid by PIP, as you've suggested, some additional expenses, some bills that the PIP carrier may not have been paid, may not have paid, and some wage loss because PIP is capped to a certain percentage. So, yes, there are some expense-type components that will be part of these claims.
Let me get the representative what he's been waiting for a question.
Actually, two, Mr. Chairman.
Two, yes, you may have them.
The first question, point of clarification, the plaintiffs in these cases often are not policyholders. There's someone suing a policyholder, right?
Correct.
Okay.
There are some instances where they could be a policyholder in an uninsured motorist type situation.
But not necessarily. In fact, I would assume in many cases they're not policyholders with someone suing a policyholder that you're insuring. Follow up, Mr.
Chairman.
Isn't there a certain imbalance in Senate Bill 50 and in the current law, namely, claim is brought by the plaintiff, defendant is subject to paying plaintiff's attorney's fees if certain conditions are met, but defendant doesn't have any opportunity at all to get its attorney's fees paid unless there's a counterclaim, not just an answer, but a counterclaim. Isn't that true?
Representative Witt, that is correct. And I believe, again, Mr. Kranovich would probably best answer that question, so I think I'm going to go ahead and let you answer that.
Are you okay with that?
I'd be fine.
Okay,
Kranovich would like to answer that.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chairman Shetterly and members of the committee. I'm Tom Kranovich, managing attorney for the Portland region. We have 11 attorneys in my office, hopefully 12 by the end of the week. My office handles probably 95%. Or has handled probably 95% of every 2080 claim that's been brought against Safeco for the last 11 years. So I will speak to you from my experience. To answer Mr. Witt's question, yes, indeed, there is an imbalance, and that was something that was discussed in the Senate hearing. Is that kosher to bring that up?
Sure.
One of the proposals or the objections against 2080 as it's currently drafted is that it's an uneven playing field as far as attorney fees are concerned. If I get a defense verdict on a 2080 case, I get nothing because I have to prevail on a counterclaim. And by case law, you prevail only if you win money. If you don't win any money, you're not a prevailing party and you're not entitled to your attorney fees. Another aspect, just to clear up some previous statements that I think needs to be mentioned is the demand is not what determines whether or not the plaintiff gets attorney fees. Indeed, the demand has to be under $4,000 and it has to be submitted 10 days in advance. What triggers the plaintiff's ability to get attorney fees is if they win more than what the insurance company either tendered or offered. So if they demand $4,000 and the insurance company offers $2,000 and they get $2,001, they will get attorney fees. They don't have to improve upon their demand. They only have to improve upon the offer. So that's a couple of legal points I thought needed to be brought up. You handled very well, Mr. Witt, the question when we were asking, you know, are we trying to screw our own insureds? No. Our insureds, in fact, are the people that are being sued under 2080. And I'd be willing to bet if you asked them if they thought it was appropriate that attorney fees be assessed against them, they'd probably say no. So, we are representing our insured's interests. It is rare that we get a 2080 case brought in a first-party claim under the Vega case, primarily because you can do so much better in first-party arbitration than you can in court. What I would like to primarily address about 2080 is that as it is now written, it works, and it works well. There hasn't been a single person come in here and tell you that it's not working. Whatever one of them has testified is that few cases go to trial because they are so small. And that is really the charm of 2080. It puts a leverage on small cases to make sure that you don't draw too hard of a line in the sand on your liability calls or on your liability splits. And it works real well, especially when you have some kind of liquidated damage. By that I mean one that's easily proven. You know, such as what's the value of your 1972 Ford Pinto before it got rear-ended as opposed to after it got rear-ended. That's usually pretty easy to determine. Where we get into the more difficult situation is where you have a general damage type of award that involves pain and suffering. And nobody on this earth can predict within 10-25% what a case is going to come in at on personal suffering. If any of us were that good, we'd hold out a shingle and be the most sought-after attorneys in the whole wide world. People would beat a track to our doors if we could predict that evenly and back it up in court every time. I can assure you we can't, because not a single attorney in here will tell you they will guarantee a result to their client. And that's because they know that it is unpredictable. And that's the area where 2080 gets real iffy and real dangerous. If it goes beyond what is a small type of claim. $7,500 is, I submit, beyond a small claim. And it can put the benefits of 2080 in jeopardy. And I say that because I can only remember my office in the last 11 years appealing two or three 2080 cases. And we do that because we had our day in front of an arbitrator, and let's remember this, that almost, well, all 2080 cases in every county in the state of Oregon go to arbitration through the court annexed arbitration system. It's not like when the bill was written and we were actually running down into district court and swearing in six jurors tried and true to render it a two-day case and render a verdict. Arbitration has taken that threat out of the court system. So they mostly go through arbitration, and it's rare that they get appealed. An increase from $4,000 to $7,500 is virtually a double in the amount. It increases the leverage on these things, and that goes to what Mr. Williams was talking about with the people that were ahead of me. And I practiced on the plaintiff's side of the bar for 5 years before I started doing insurance defense work. And I, like Mr. Williams, also had occasion where I had a case that was probably worth $4,500, maybe $5,000. But I put it down into 2080 for $4,000 after talking to my client. My client knew the risk was that if I made a demand for $4,000, the insurance company might pay it. But bingo, so what? If they paid it, all I had was a demand letter in the file. I charged him $100, gave him $3,900. He went home perfectly happy, far more happy than if I had gone into trial with a 33% contingency on a $5,000 case and taken $1,500 out of there. So the reason that we do that is nothing onerous in the law. It's because by bringing our claim within the purview of 2080, we actually increase the net to our client, at the same time putting leverage on the insurance company, because we're no longer, when we're against an insurance company, we're no longer limited to what a contingency fee might be on our recovery. No, on a 2080 case, it's an hourly fee. And so the incentive, rather than to quickly move cases and get them along under 2080 once the case has been filed, is to make sure that you turn every rock over so that your client gets his due day in court, and of course that sends up billable hours, and if you prevail, you're going to win. Not a contingency fee of one-third or 40%, but whatever your billable hours is. And those of us who have been down this road before have had cases that we still wake up at night about, in which it was a $3,500 award and a $6,000 attorney fee. Not pleasant memories, but it's quite capable of happening. Oregon allows attorney fees on very few cases. Some states do allow attorney fees on all cases, Alaska being one of them, but Oregon does not. And Oregon has had the opportunity to do that in the past and has always chosen not to do that. The exception in Oregon is cases where you are contractually bound to give up attorney fees, or cases where it's statutorily allowed. And I submit that the real purpose behind that was, again, to give attorney fees in cases where the damages were somewhat liquidated and not where they were the sky is the limit type of a damage. And that's what the purpose of ORS 2080 is. If you raise the limit too high, I submit that we are then in a position where more cases will be appealed. It makes more sense for an insurance company to appeal an arbitration award of $7,200 than it does to appeal an arbitration award of $3,200. It kind of interested me that the bar came forward and said that the judges wanted it raised to $10,000. My immediate reaction was, why? these cases go through mandatory arbitration anyway. Anything under $50,000 goes through mandatory arbitration. From my own personal experience, very few of them were appealed, three of them maybe in the last 11 years. I don't think I'm clogging up too many people's dockets. So I don't know what the judge's thinking was in $10,000. I submit that, if anything, because of the increased possibility of appeal, it will enhance their caseload and not minimize their caseload. Another thing to realize, again, because of the arbitration procedure, is that juries, especially in my home county of Clackamas County, Representative Lowe can speak to this, take a very hard look at bodily injuries. And it's not unusual for a jury in Clackamas County to come back with an award of $4,000. And for that reason, those types of cases could well be appealed. There are a few counties in this state that are a little more liberal than that. I won't go into that, but you know, these cases are evaluated on a county-by-county basis. And again, I submit that raising this to the point where the balance gets out of whack will increase litigation. So a couple of things. I think you have a couple of things to choose between. One is the compromise that was earlier agreed upon. That was a fair compromise. And the other one is to address what Mr. Witt started to talk about, and that is, let's even the playing field. And if we're going to have attorney fees, let's have attorney fees for everybody on these cases. So if I get a defense verdict, I get my attorney fees against the plaintiff. Now, of course, that has a chilling effect because plaintiffs don't have, well, hopefully they'll have insurance if I have a counterclaim. But if I brought no counterclaim against them and I get a defense verdict, now they have to pay attorney fees out of their own pocket. Is that fair? I don't know. That's, again, we're back to where, when I talked to you 4 weeks ago, your job to balance these conflicting types of interests. But I submit the track record that 2080 has had for the past 14 years shows that it works, it's effective, and we've compromised it at the $5,000, and that's what you should go with.
Representative Witt, you had a question.
Yeah, Mr. Kranovich, is it fair to assume that your the settlements that you enter into with plaintiffs under these types of cases and the attorney's fees that you expend or are exposed to on these types of cases get passed on to your policyholders?
Yes, most definitely.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Kranovich, good to see you again. It's always nice to see one of my old law school teachers.
I'm trying to avoid this becoming a habit.
A question I guess that I'd have, I don't know if you practice. Do you do any Washington practice or any other neighboring state practice?
No, I have an amusing story I can tell you about that sometime, but I don't go north of the river. They recognize me and run me out of a town immediately.
Okay. I guess I'm just wondering, do you know of any other states, neighboring states, that have a similar statute like Oregon's?
This is completely off the top of my head. You're talking about like 2080?
Yeah, right.
I believe most states have a 2080 type of statute.
Okay. You wouldn't. I just wondered if you. I thought maybe because of your relationship with Safeco, you might know if Washington has a similar statute, what its rate or limit is at.
I believe they have a similar statute. I don't know what the rate is.
Okay. That's something I can find out. I just thought I'd ask if you knew while you were here.
Representative Lowe.
Thanks.
Speaking in defense of Clackamas County juries?
Darn good.
They're
no,
fine.
No, actually, what Tom's
jury.
Saying is absolutely
compared to Polk County, they're generous.
The painful truth. It is. I was just, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just wondering, you know, trying to come up with a reason why the bench might be in favor of upping the ante to 10K, and that just might, I don't know, shove more of these in arbitrate. I sit on the arbitration panel, and I was just trying to think of why in the world that would be.
Well, Representative Shetterly and Representative Lowe, you're much closer to a circuit judge than I ever hoped to be. And
thanks, Tom. That'll end up on the signed eye tape. I appreciate that. I did have one question.
Okay, sure.
Thank you. Looking at Mr. Clement's claims,
you gave about four or five terrible things that would happen if the ante is increased to 5K or beyond 5K, is that right?
Yes.
And you said more litigation, higher premiums, increased cost of settlements, more appeals of arbitration, and potential fraudulent claims. Why, I just thought that for the record it might be good to have on there why you thought that there would be more appeals of arbitrations rather than just letting the cases kind of die a quick death in arbitration.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lowe, the reason I believe there would be more appeals of arbitrations is simply as you raise the amount awarded in arbitration, if that amount is perceived to be too out of balance as to what the claim is actually worth, in our opinion, we would be then likely to seek a judicial redress and have a jury tell us what the value of the claim is. I hate to say that, but I think the proof of the matter is that arbitration awards tend to be higher on average than jury awards. But at $3,000 or $4,000, we're probably not willing to take it another step to find out. At $7,500, and assuming that's also on top of medical bills that might be outside of this, we're now dealing with a larger claim, and we're not going to be quite as willing to pay $7,500 when we believe a jury may only award $4,000. So that's sort of the reason why we feel that way.
Representative Walker, did you have your hand up? No.
Yeah, just taking
it. She denies it. Representative Werbelow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, you've been talking about the medicals on top of, I mean, I don't know what Safeco's particular practice is, but most insurance companies I've dealt with under these claims offset the medical expenses. These are small cases, and they'll say, okay, we'll settle for $3,500, and we'll pay $2,000 of it to the PIP carrier, and you get the remainder.
May I address that?
Yes.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I'm going to be very careful about this. Representative Urbelow, is that correct? Thank you.
Don't worry about it.
In response to that, let me say this. If the insurance companies are doing that to you, then it's real easy to handle. You simply make your pleading under 2080 and you don't include your medical bills, and you live up to the PIP carrier's letter that most of them send you that says you do not represent our interests. And as such, they can go pound sand as far as trying to take anything out of your award. If you plead for general damages only and do not plead for your medicals, then they cannot offset it because you don't represent their interests. They're going to have to have their own action against the other carrier. Most carriers in Oregon belong to a mandatory PIP arbitration panel anyway.
Okay.
But but anything goes while you're negotiating. I mean, I know all that stuff, but as you're talking back and forth trying to settle the case, and these cases are small, and many of them are to the advantage for everybody to settle it. And so that does occur. Otherwise, you're going to get all entangled and go into court, and that's what you're trying to avoid.
Do you have a question for me on that?
No.
Okay.
But I mean, you just put some flavor on there that doesn't exist in real life sometimes.
Oh, sometimes it doesn't, but I have found very often that the attorneys will not plead that. The same is true when I go into what I used to call big boy court when we had circuit and district courts. And, the guys just wouldn't plead their medical bills, and the carriers would be wringing their hands. They wanted to get everything lumped at one time, and that was just tough luck. You've told me I don't represent your interests, period. I don't represent them.
Representative Wells.
Thank you. I just had a procedural question where we're headed here with this bill. We have it coming over from the Senate that it seemed like an agreed-upon amount. Do we have an amendment to move it back, or then we're going to go back and argue this out between the House and the Senate? Or what's the procedure here?
Well,
I was thrown off a little bit when we had testimony coming in talking about the $7,500, which really isn't the bill that's in front of me. So I don't see any amendments. So where are we going with this bill?
Well, I'm about to close the hearing. We got some requests for information from some members here. and so we'll bring this back, but we do have, not in LC form, but a proposed amendment today from the Practice and Procedure Committee to raise it, and there's nothing before us in LC form for us to act on, but we do have a couple requests for information before we move the thing, so my inclination today is just to close the hearing, and we'll bring it back up. But you're right, what we have before us is the bill that would raise it to $5,000, and that's all we have before us.
And Mr. Chairman, it seems like everybody's in agreement on that, so I was wondering really what we were arguing about
well,
here. But
yeah, I get to answer. I think it is interesting that we have Mr. Mao and Ms. Hankin signed up in favor of the bill, and they argued against it. And then we have Mr. Powell and the insurance folks arguing, signed up against the bill, and they're arguing in favor of it, basically, as it's in
yeah,
front of
Mr.
us here.
Mr. Chair, I've already been a little confused here just what we're doing, because I have no paperwork in front of me talking about $7,500, and I thought we had this ironed out, and so I've been kind of trying to figure out which way we are going on this. It kind of reminds me of a jigsaw. I mean, we're just kind of going back and forth, cutting wood here, and I'm sleepier the longer I sit here.
We're about to wrap this up, I can assure you, Lana.
Let me say for the record, Mr. Chair, that Safeco can live with the $5,000. Anything over that, we will oppose. Thank you for letting us come.
Representative Witt, sure.
Mr. Before they leave, Mr. Chairman, I was told that there was, in essence, a compromise reached in the Senate on this at $5,000. And if that's true, if those who were parties to that compromise, I wonder why we're coming back and we're reevaluating that compromise or renegotiating this at a higher number.
I understand. Okay. Well, we'll bring this back, close the public hearing on Senate Bill 50. Thank you, everybody, for filling the first hour. I'll bet we'll move a little faster with the next one, Senate Bill 176. I'll open a public hearing on that. Council?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Senate Bill 176A provides the procedure for removal and sale of an abandoned boat, floating home or boathouse, and it prohibits the law enforcement agency from taking a boat, seizing a boat before time to request a hearing expires. It requires notice to be posted on the boat, specifying when the hearing is, and also to hold a hearing if the boat owner was to contest the validity of the proposing removal, and specifies that the decision of the law enforcement agency following the hearing is a final order which may be appealed to the circuit court. And it creates the offense of abandoning a boat and punishes that by maximum imprisonment of 1 year, $5,000, or both. Mr. Chairman.
Okay. We've got some folks signed up to testify for this. Let's bring you all together. Paul Don Hefner, John Rachel, and Jennifer Robinson. My bet is the more succinct testimony, the better your vote count will be on the committee. So just tell us what it is.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, I'm Paul Don Hefner, Director of the Marine Board. This morning I had the challenge of trying to tell a committee in 5 minutes or less or the bill was dead. I don't know if I can do it in five minutes or less, but I'll give it my best shot.
I was on that committee this morning, and I think your bill made it through, didn't it?
We did. Mr. Chairman, members, Paul Don Hefner, Director of the Marine Board. We requested this bill in an effort to improve the current statutory process dealing with abandoned boats and floating homes on the waters of the state. The bill streamlines and simplifies that process that must be used to deal with these kinds of structures. In virtually all of the instances and cases we've been involved with in the past, we're dealing with property that has virtually no value. It's junk. It's derelict. The problem with the current statute is that it requires that a boat be abandoned for 3 months before the sheriff can begin the process of seeking removal. During that delay, the property usually becomes even more difficult to remove, particularly if it partially or fully sinks or begins to break up. And there's no provision in the current law to act quickly, even if it poses a hazard to navigation or to public safety. Under the current law, after 3 months, there's a 30-day notice requirement, and then another 90 days is provided in the current law for the owner to come forward and reclaim the property before it can be removed. So right now we've got a minimum of 4 months and up to 7 months worth of process before we can deal with these kinds of things. And usually, as I said, no one comes forward because we're dealing with stuff that truly is junk. So the abandoned boats are left in place. They become a public nuisance, an eyesore, possible environmental or navigation hazard. The bill before you simplifies that process. It provides a uniform procedure for dealing with abandoned boats and floating homes. It expands the authority to allow other law enforcement agencies to participate. So if it's abandoned within the city limits, city or municipality could step up. It's not necessarily the sheriff that has to act under this. The bill was drafted with input from the Sheriff's Association, with the Division of State Lands, the Portland Fire Bureau, and others. We worked closely together to develop it. The bill was amended slightly in the Senate Judiciary Committee to improve upon the process, to streamline it a little further, and to provide for an appeal in the case that a person does step forward, request a hearing, and is not satisfied with the outcome of that hearing. There is an appeal process set up for them. I could go through it section by section, but I think that really, in a nutshell, kind of summarizes what the bill's about. It's an effort to simplify the process, give us a more uniform means of dealing with this property, and it was passed unanimously by the Senate Judiciary Committee, as well as by the Senate. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Representative Williams.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Hefner, I'm looking at maybe it just cites it from another part of the statute, but how do you define abandoned? What are you using as your definition for abandonment?
Chairman, Representative Williams, it's abandoned if it is left on the waters of the state or upon public or private property, except with permission of the owner, or in an established or attended moorage or an area leased for occupation by the Division of State Lands in lines 14 through 17.
Follow up?
Yes.
And I saw that definition or that where it describes the committing the offense of abandoning. But what I didn't see there is typically in abandonment there's some sort of a time frame.
I think that's on page 2.
Oh, okay.
Lines.
Okay.
5 through 7, is that 48 hours?
Yes.
Okay. That's what I was looking for. So it links the two together. Okay, thank you.
Question.
Representative Wolf.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There's a marina in my district. I think it's in my district. Maybe it's in Schrader's district. But anyway, there's a marina where there's, on occasion that I've wandered down there, I've seen some one boat in particular comes to mind, sort of half in, half out of the water below the. Anyway, it's partially sinking and in a really bad condition. And I guess the owner kind of shows up about once every 2 years and pays the mortgage fees. So under this, if his fees are late or delinquent or something, then would that enable you guys to come in and take the boat? Because obviously, not having paid his fees, he's not there with the permission of the mortgage owner.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lowe, if the boat's in an established and attended mortgage, this would not have us taking action against it so long as it's in a marina.
Well, if it's in a marina but not paid for?
Had the owner not paid his fees, then the marina owner would have, under a different statute, the ability to attach a lien on it.
So this isn't going to just, like, let his rent lapse for 2 days and then...
No.
Okay, good.
That is the specific exception, then, for mortgages on line 16 and 17 on the first page of the bill. Is that right? Is that?
Yeah, well, I did read that, but I didn't... But then we had the 48-hour thingy to look at in tandem, so...
The 48 hours, if it's outside an established or attended mortgage, if it's...
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
Either one of the other two of you want
to... Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Reichel. I'm Flathead County Sheriff, and I'm before you today as the Oregon State Sheriff's Association's Marine Affairs Committee Chair. As Director Don Hefner has stated this, we work closely with the Marine Board on this issue. The Oregon State Sheriff's Association supports this bill. It is usually us who works intimately with having to deal with abandoned boats. Often they are abandoned and are ignored until just before the winter storms or the runoffs when they end up into public waterways and navigational ways. The current process requires, it's cumbersome and requires us to put often to moor these at a public moorage at expense to the public until the process can continue. They're not always something that can be pulled out of the water. This bill would make the process much more efficient, and the balance that was struck with the amendments coming out of the Senate does offer anybody who has a lien interest in these vessels or float homes a very balanced due process. And so we urge you to support
that. I assume that must be the case because the banks and the credit unions aren't here today. So, all right, Ms. Robinson.
Chair Shetterly, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Jennifer Robinson, Special Assistant to the Director, Division of State Lands, testifying today on behalf of Director Clary. The Division of State Lands is pleased to support Senate Bill 176. I think of this in terms of driving up Highway 101, and just about every river you cross, you can look over and there's half of a boat visible up against the bank or out in the mud. Frequently these occur on state-owned submerged submersible lands, and people call the Division of State Lands to abate the nuisance, and we have no authority or process to do that, and we think this would be a big help, and we would appreciate your favorable consideration.
I hear a work session coming on by the sound of files closing, so let's do that. I'll close the public hearing and open the work session on Senate Bill 176. Yeah. Representative Orbelow.
I move that we have
Representative Orbelow moves Senate Bill 176A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Please call the roll.
Representative Beckman?
Aye.
Representative Edwards?
Excused.
Representative Lowe?
Aye.
Representative
Orbelow? Yes.
Representative Walker?
Yes.
Representative
Lowe? Yes.
Representative Williams?
Aye.
Representative
Witt? Aye. Aye. Senate Bill 176A goes before the due pass recommendation. Do we have any boaters in the crowd that would like to carry this? Representative Walker, you're elected.
I have a canoe.
And with that, we are adjourned.
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to be gone tomorrow.
Hey, Vicki.
Did you get my letter yet?
I have an appropriate bill for you to answer.
It might be on my calendar.